This is Pat Loika, and you're listening to Loika Mania. How's it going, everyone? Welcome to Loika Mania, episode 45. Once again, I am joined by our good buddy, Adam Witt. Adam, welcome back.
Hey, Pat.
Well, you were missed when we talked to Brian Bendis last week, but, you know, this week we get...
You didn't miss me that much.
Well, yeah.
You don't need to lie to me.
Yeah,
it's cool, man. I can take it.
Sometimes,
it's all good.
Sometimes I forget that you're part of the show, but that's okay.
Okay, kidding. That just wasn't nice. No,
I'm kidding.
Today, do you see what he does to me, people?
Jesus. I mean, you see what's...
Send hate mail and defenses of me to the Loika at gmail.com.
Actually, it's loikamania at gmail.com.
Did you change it?
No. I figured, you know, we should have, like, a podcast-only, you know, email. So, yes, if you have any comments or any problems or whatever, questions, send them to loikamania at gmail.com. That's spelled L-O. It's the same. It's the name of the podcast at gmail.com. So if you can't do that, then there's something wrong. But seriously, on to what's going on now. We have today one of our favorite writers. God, I was actually really nervous to talk to this guy because he is one of my favorites, one of the smartest, one of the funniest writers out there, and he's such a big idea guy. He's a genius, I honestly believe, and he is of course Rick Remender, and he writes some of my favorite comics right now, and it is an honor to get to talk to him. We talked to him about process stuff, working on video games like Bulletstorm, and talk about Frank and Castle for quite a bit as well, and of course we talk a bit about, you know, working in the comics industry, you know, whether you were a writer or an inker or an artist, there's plenty of things to learn from Rick. I think he is a very fascinating guy, and, you know, our chat with him certainly speaks volumes about him, you know?
Yeah, I hadn't really seen any interviews with him. You know, we record the bumpers after the interview's done, and I really hadn't seen any interviews or heard any interviews with him, but, man, he's such a cool guy, and he's one of those guys that flew under the radar for a while. Like, he's, you know, he talks about that in the show, but a lot of the indie guys, you know, like the dudes that go through the Image and Dark Horse stuff, picked up on him early and knew that he was probably going to end up somewhere like that soon. And yeah, he's very deserving of it. He does, like you were saying, his ideas are just huge. He really mines the sort of concepts that he goes into for everything they're worth. And, yeah, man, he does really incredible work.
Yeah, you know, we had the honor of speaking with him, and we got to chat with him for a full hour, actually, where he and Adam almost got into it in a different way, and you'll hear it at the beginning of the interview. But yes,
oh, yeah.
this is, you know, we're very proud of the show, so hopefully you guys enjoy it as much as we did, you know, recording it. So if you have any questions, like I said, send us email at loikamania@gmail.com, and Adam, where can people find you on the internet?
People can find me at, you can always look me up on Facebook, Adam Witt, AdamWitt, and at twitter.com/AdamWitt. And, you know, like we were saying, check out Rick Remender's books. You know, you can go somewhere like, you know, our friends at GraphicNovels.com. You can check them out there. Go on Amazon. Go wherever you need to. You know, go to your local shop, whatever. Give this guy some attention because he deserves it.
Yeah, and of course he wrote the video game Bulletstorm. If you have a PS3 or an Xbox, you may want to check it out because it's a lot of fun. It's a fun shooter. So, yeah, give him a try. And once again, thank you for listening. Thank you also for the very nice feedback we've been getting. Like, I've been getting a lot of feedback for the DC episode that we did and for the episode we did with Brian Bendis and with Jason Aaron. Thank you for all the nice words, and just be sure to you know, show us some love by going to our page on iTunes and leaving a review or something. You know, that'd be nice. We would greatly appreciate that. Anyways, enough of us talking here. We'll let you guys enjoy our chat with Mr. Rick Remender. Take it easy. And we're back. Of course, I'm still joined by Adam, and this time we are joined by probably one of our favorite creators, who does probably some of the most interesting and most, I'll say, original works from Image, and he does Uncanny X-Force for Marvel and Venom. He is Mr. Rick Remender. Welcome, Rick.
Thanks for having me.
Go ahead, Adam.
Yeah, I was a big fan of Fear Agent from when it started up. I jumped on, I think, with the first trade, and one year I gave it to a friend for Christmas. It turned out it was the first comic he'd ever read. Like, I bought it for him. He's like, yeah, I've never read a comic before. And he fell in love with it, went and tracked down all your other work, and went and, you know, got Bulletstorm and things like that, and just absolutely loves your stuff. And
is this where you ask for some sort of a royalty payment?
Because yeah. You know, I hope you weren't onto my scent there. I really, man. Pat, you said that you wouldn't do
really,
this.
You kind of owe me probably, like, I don't know, $50.
I'll knock it down to 25.
Well, and I appreciate that. That's very nice to hear. You know, it's also nice when you know that somebody who wasn't reading comic books got hooked, you know.
Yeah, it's made him track down a whole bunch of other stuff. He went and even, like, went into your Marvel stuff and just has fallen in love with all of it. And, yeah, we just, you know, commend you for doing really super accessible stuff.
Well, I commend you for sending people to my super accessible stuff. Look at this. Love's in the air. Couple of dudes on the phone in love.
Should I leave you guys alone for a couple minutes? Or?
So what are you wearing, Adam?
Nothing.
See, you just went to a very, very dark place I did not want to go into.
You want to go there. Don't you back up. You're standing, you're on the precipice now. All you have to do is lean a little bit, and it's all going to happen. I feel all a flutter, and I just don't know what to do. You just have to let it happen, Pat. Just lean in.
Yeah, I'll let go, and I'll just let it happen. But, you know, on a more serious note, for what Adam just said, just going off what he just said, what I love about your work is that it is really accessible. Like, anyone can pick up your books, whether it's a it's your creator own work or your Marvel stuff, and you really jump in there, and you don't feel like you're lost. You know what's going on. So a few recent issues of X-Force, for example, you just pick up, like, a random issue, and you're pretty much kept on the loop as to what's going on, and it's easy to jump in. And not many people are good at doing that. And I always thought, you know, what kind of thought process is involved with you when you're writing your books to make sure that anyone, you know, with the mentality that this is always going to be someone's first comic. Like, what was there anything specific that you think of when you do that?
Well, I think that even when I'm doing grander arcs, I try and have something of a self-contained story in each issue, and I don't always succeed at that, but I always try and have some sort of a satisfying beginning, middle, and end. The guys I work with, we all like compressed storytelling, and so you get, I think, the way I work is I normally write 30 to 35 pages for a comic book, mm-hmm. and then I whittle it down to 20 or 22. And what happens there is you still get the 32 pages, but I've cut out every unnecessary beat. And so putting more in the book in terms of succinct and concise storytelling, you have opportunities to do bits of, I wouldn't even say recap, but banter or stage setting where you can get back into a character's head and sort of reestablish the scenario, even if it is part of a grander story, and keep new readers abreast. Now, that's not always going to be the case, and it doesn't always work out that way. But it's something that I'm mindful of, I never take for granted that anybody knows anything about a character, and it's important, I think, because take Kraven, for example. You know, like, I grew up reading a lot of cool Kraven comics, and I was a big Spider-Man nerd, and so when I got to do Kraven versus Venom, it would have been, my first instinct was like, I'm just, it's just, and Craven's doing this thing, and Craven's this, and I know Craven, so I just started writing it, and I realized, you know, what about people who don't know Craven, or what about people who haven't seen Craven in a while? At that point, I realized, you know, some internal captions from Craven to sort of get back into his mindset and who he is and why he's doing what he's doing. It might, it'll only take me a page or two to do it, but it'll really help, I think, people enjoy the experience of reading this character to have a something, wouldn't even say a refresher course, but just to sort of get reacclimated to who he is and his mindset. So on mainstream books, I still try and treat famous characters as if they're new, because they are new to somebody, and do something with them or get back into their heads in a way that will help sort of, you know, redefine them.
Awesome. You like I mentioned, you do a pretty good job with that. And I have a friend actually who had picked up who started picking up Uncanny X-Force because of he likes all the characters in the book, and he only started reading comics about a couple of years ago. And because of what you have been doing lately, he actually got into he was interested enough in the stuff that you were doing that he decided to start picking up the Age of Apocalypse stuff that came up over a decade ago. So, you do a good job with letting people know what's going on and what's there. And it's kind of nice that, you know, it's having a positive effect on people who are reading your stuff. Now, before you started doing all the Marvel stuff, though, you had quite a catalog of creator-owned work. And one of the things I love about your stuff is that you're such a you do have a lot of big ideas, you know, like stuff like Gigantic, The Last Days of American Crime, Nightmare, Sorrow, Sea of Red, all that stuff. And Fear Agent, of course, which is like one of the best books, you know, of the last decade, in my opinion. And I always wonder, you know, like what exactly inspires you to create all these different things in these different genres? Is it just you trying to kind of get into different things, or just trying to discover what you could do with, you know, with certain genres? Or what exactly is your mindset when you're creating a new book and you're trying to do something different?
It's not that I'm setting out to necessarily work in other genres. It's just that I'm fascinated by all kinds of genres, mm-hmm. you know, crime and horror and fantasy and science fiction and all these things are interesting to me. Mm-hmm. You know, I've been bathing in the sea of these things since I was a kid as, a long-term nerd. So I think that more than anything, what it'll be is an idea will come to me. Mm-hmm. Or I'll be sitting around with a friend and an idea will come up through conversation, mm-hmm. And I'll be like, holy shit, that's actually kind of a funny idea. Like XXX Zombies was a phone call with Tony Moore. Hold on for one second.
Sure.
Excuse me. Was a phone call with Tony Moore mm-hmm. where I was making a joke. We were talking about, something of a zombie storyline in Fear Agent that we had planned, and it ended up being an arc that Jerome Pena drew. And they were really more ghouls than they were zombies. They were like soul-feeding ghouls. Mm-hmm. And I think we were talking about the planning stages for that, and I don't even remember the conversation, but I was talking about how, you know what we should do, you know, we should just get right down to the thick of things and have a bunch of, you know, hot prostitutes and porn stars and you know, macho 70s dudes driving around in muscle cars during the zombie apocalypse. And we both laughed pretty hard. And then I was sharing a studio with Kieran Dwyer at the time in San Francisco, and I went into the office next day and mentioned it to him. And he came up with the title. You know, he said, XXX Zombies. Yeah, there you go. And I said, all right, well, you're going to draw that. And he was actually into it. So we got to work on it. And the next thing you know, we're just having a ridiculously good time making a zombie apocalypse story that follows a band of porn stars around, in the mid-70s, which hasn't been done, I don't think. And that's... That's always the fun, is trying to find some kind of a mashup of genre and era that hasn't been done. So, you know, all these things are born of different, different things. Sorrow was born, I was coming back from San Diego, driving back to San Francisco, and I was in the car with a friend of mine, and I was we were talking about the Evil Dead, and I was talking about Twin Peaks and how much possession creeps me out, just the idea of possession, somebody coming becoming possessed. And so Sorrow was born. I wanted to explore possession. So, you know, there's a lot of different ways these things will come about. Last Days of American Crime was a reaction to I actually started writing it right after 9/11. Mm-hmm. And it was a reaction to watching the country sort of gladly give over personal liberties and privacy in lieu of some sort of imagined security.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea being that how far would we allow this to go if the government had a broadcast that would just make terrorism and crime impossible, but it would make all crime, even littering, even, you know, putting anything would be impossible. Would we be willing to do that for security and safety? And then that led to, well, you know, if we did do that, if it did exist, what happens, blah, blah, blah. And then the next thing I know, I'm imagining, you know, some tough grifter, bank robber, trying to get a last job finished. And then mm-hmm. I was like, well, that's a lot of craziness, but I'm going to do that, I think. And so, you know, they're all born of these various different, it's zeitgeist a lot of the time, you know, like, you know, I have plenty of things that I didn't do that I had cooked up and started working on, and then somebody else announced the very same idea. I think a lot of it is just the soup that we're all stewing in, and, you know, various TV and comics and books and film.
How important is collaboration to you? I mean, you co-write with a good handful of people. Is that something you actively seek out?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think that you get a lot of interesting things out of it. You know, sometimes it works better than others. I think that it's also important in terms of you know, suppressing the ego. I think that when you work with somebody else, you need to compromise and do things their way occasionally, and it becomes a very different suit. Like Sea of Red, you know, co-writing that with Kieran Dwyer. That thing was very different than what it would have been had I done it on my own. Kieran had a lot of big ideas, you know, I think that in terms of collaboration in general, I always get on the phone if I have the opportunity and talk to my artists as I'm working to see how they might want me to adjust an action scene, or if they have any visual ideas or cues that they would want me to take, because. You know, I think that one thing that's happened in this industry is we've become so, or at least it seems to be that the writers have become such a focus. But it really overlooks the reality that this is sequential. These are cartoons. I mean, this is cartooning. This is the majority of what you see in the emotion of it is sold by a quality artist who can tell story and stage and the expressions of the characters and all of these things that take an artist 6 to 8 weeks to put on page. It takes me 8 to 10 days on a script if you include outline time and rewrites, and I do a lot of dialogue polishes to try and cut down the word count to make sure that the art isn't obscured by my ego. So for me, it's all a collaboration. And as soon as, like, I always wince whenever there's an article online that says Rick Remender's something or other, because it leaves out the guy who did most of the work and who matters the most. My voice is there, and I'm not downplaying the importance of a quality script, but I think we've really lost sight of just how this is an artist medium, and it's ridiculous to not include the artist's name next to the writer's when you're talking about a work. So it's all collaborative, and I think to overlook that and to just think that you're going to make your best work by, you know, writing what you want and making somebody draw it, you know, like they're just a wrist. They're just an extension of your genius, and they can go off and make my genius real, Art Monkey. You know, like, I think that the reason I work with so many quality artists is that I respect them and I respect what they do, and we do collaborate. I get on the phone with Jerome and Tony and everybody I work with, and we talk out the story. And you know, these guys are all super creative and all have a lot of amazing ideas as well. So it benefits the story because my head might be on one track and they'll be like, well, what if this guy did this? And I'm like, oh, fuck, that's terrific. That's a great little beat there. And then they're more excited to draw it because they're invested in the story. It's not some egotist handing them their genius ideas, you know, like, here you go, enjoy drawing my ideas. It's our ideas. And it's something that we're all invested in collaborating on together. And, you know, that's also why I've always shared ownership on my projects. And even when, like, you know, on Fear Agent, when Jerome came in on issue, you know, 5, we still cut him in on media stuff. And I think that it's important that everybody feel invested and involved and that we don't lose sight or let our egos obscure the reality here, that it is collaborative and most of the work is done on the art end.
Speaking of the art end of creating in comics, and you of course started as an artist. Well, you did a lot of you've illustrated your own stuff in LCD, for example, in Captain Dingleberry.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I remember that. I have some of the stuff that you guys were giving away back at Comic-Con way back, like the stickers, like, you know, there's like the sticker of the finger and all those guys.
Wow.
Yeah, and I remember that stuff, and that was fun stuff. And of course, for a time you were actually doing ink work for on Avengers for Kieron, and I was always wondering, like, you know, how was your experience working on that end beforehand? I mean, you were kind of there like towards the end of the 90s, and you were doing mostly art related stuff until you started doing Blackheart Billy. And I always thought how your experience was doing drawing and why you decided to just go to just writing on its own.
It's not entirely accurate. Mm-hmm. Most of the guys I was inspired by to get into comic books, I had been disillusioned and sort of lost my interest in superhero comics in mm-hmm. general mm-hmm. by the mid to late 90s. And I was more, I was neck deep in reading books by guys who wrote and drew, like David mm-hmm. Latham and Evan Dorkin and Dan Klaus and Adrian Tomine. So those were the guys whose voices and, you know, what they did spoke to me, and they were writers and artists. They were cartoonists. So for me, that's what I was trying to do, and I wanted to do something that also spoke to my love of insane, over-the-top, you know, my pulp sensibility and my, mm-hmm. my love of superhero comics, and that was what sort of led to Captain Dingleberry, which was inspired by this Frank Zappa song off of Joe's Garage, a friend of mine. That was all born. I was an animator at the time. I was working for Don Bluth, and the other animators I worked with at lunch, we would all sit around and cook up goofy characters and draw comics. So for me, the goal was always to write and draw. Unfortunately, the realities, I kept having to turn down in-house work at video game companies and film studios to keep fighting out this dream of doing comics. And the reality is that the way I draw, I cartoon, it's my influences are Wally Wood and Will Elder, mm-hmm. And guys who are a little more exaggerated. And so for me, as my style progressed, and I was always writing, drawing, and animate, you know, I was animating and storyboarding, you know, and teaching at the Academy in San Francisco. To pay the bills while I was doing all this comic book stuff. Captain Dingleberry, I wrote that and drew that, you know, co-wrote it and co-drew it. Mm-hmm. And then Blackheart Billy, I co-wrote that and co-drew it, drew some, inked Kieron on others, did finishes on Kieron's breakdowns on others, Kieron inked me on some others. So that was just a mashup of Kieron and Harper Jayton and I. And that was from 98 until about 2000 mm-hmm. that I was doing that stuff. And during that time, I started working on my first solo project, which was Doll and Creature, that I wrote entirely, and then John Hebank and Mike Manley did the artwork. And then I think that obviously the stuff in LCD, that was all cartooning, you know, everything I did in there, tons of stuff that I wrote and drew, and other stuff that I, you know, co-wrote and Kieron drew, mash up again. But I think that, you know, so for me it was always, I was doing both, but some of the things became a little more prominent a little quicker. In terms of comic book stuff, around 2000, Kieran was offered the Avengers, and so I was sharing the studio with him, and you know, he asked me if I would ink him, and you know, or I was like, you know, hey, I'd love to ink that. However, it came about, it was just a natural fit, and it was a ton of fun, but it was a mistake. Because, you know, I'd already been doing and trying to, you know, write and draw my own work at that point for 3 years, four years, I guess, really, if you think about the, when I started. Mm-hmm. And now I've just put my name on the Avengers as finisher inker. And that was the first, most people knew of me. And that really fucked me up in terms of where I was going in my career, because in the mainstream, all of a sudden, now I had a name, but the name was Kieran Dwyer's Finisher. And that was, for me at the time, it was just like a job. I was like, oh, I could get the page rate out of this, and I get to do some finishes over Kieran, who's a genius, and work on the Avengers. That'll be a lot of fun. So that really hobbled my career, I think, in terms of you know, where I was at the time. And so between 2000 and 2005, you know, I penciled some Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. I penciled I was working as a storyboard artist. I was teaching, and I was also putting together creator-owned books. Blackheart Billy, Doll and Creature, and Captain Dingleberry had already come out. Mm-hmm. And so I was putting together ideas for Fear Agent, for Sea of Red, for Nightmare, for Strange Girl, for you know, Last Days of American Crime, The End League, Gigantic, all of these things I was putting together. I would, you know, go into EA and work as a storyboard artist all day, and come, you know, in the afternoon I'd teach a class at the academy, and then I'd go to my office and I would write and draw and try and create ideas. And it took a while before I actually pitched them. And I think in 2004 I sent out Nightmare, Fear Agent, Strange Girl, Sea of Red, a couple of others. And they were all picked up. IDW picked up one. Dark Horse hired me to work with Bruce Campbell on draw one of his comics. And then Image approved three books as well. So I was all, you know, I was suddenly very, you know, I was suddenly buried with stuff. And none of it easy. It was all creator-owned stuff that you have to generate. And you have to keep it moving. And you, you know, basically put it together and make your own comics. Unfortunately, as an artist, I have a lot of friends who could help with that. And that led to, you know, drawing another book for Brian Posehn and Jerry Duggan that I penciled the
Last Christmas.
Yeah. And at that point, I thought I would still be doing that. I figured, you know, I'm going to write and create stories for other artists as well as draw on the side. And I figured I could manage both. Mm-hmm. So for me, my career was always, I was going to be cartooning things like Man with the Screaming Brain and The Last Christmas, and writing things like Fear Agent and Nightmare and books like that. But then the writing kind of took off, and I didn't anticipate that it would. I really didn't. I've always worked hard on both ends. I've studied and done my homework to try and become, you know, good and make sure that I had an eye towards focusing on craft over sensationalism or anything else, or pandering to current tastes. And I guess around 2007. I started getting work offers from places like Dynamite and then DC, and then that led to the Marvel stuff in 2008. Mm-hmm. Matt asked me if I would hop on War Journal with him because he was blowing up and had too much work. And you know, obviously I was appreciative and eager to you know, take a stab at some Marvel stuff. So, yeah, you know, here we are a few years later, and the writing has, you know, blown up, and I don't have time to draw. I haven't drawn anything in, you know, 3 years, I guess.
Oh, wow, yeah. I always liked your work because, your cartooning, rather, because I thought it was very expressive, and I thought, you know, there was really an emphasis on the storytelling aspect of the work, and I always enjoyed it. So I'm hoping that eventually a day will come where you kind of revisit that and draw again. I don't know. Do you still draw right now when you're just for yourself anyway?
I don't. You know, I don't, and I want to. I've been working between, you know, the last couple of years. I had between screenplays and comic books and video games. I've had so much writing work that I've been in my office 13, 14 hours a day. and I've had two kids in the past 2 years. We have a 2-year-old and a 5-month-old. So beyond having the two kids and the work, I haven't had, you know, I've done some sketchbook pages, and when I'm on airplanes, I draw people, and I try and keep my chops at least somewhat up. But no, it's on my list, you know, like I keep wanting to make some proclamation of a promise that this is the year I write and draw my own book again. Mm-hmm. But it's a high problem. It's a high class problem to have, that I've got too much writing work to make that possible.
Yeah, and I imagine also it must be really cool to be receiving, like pages from other artists of stuff that you come up with, you know. There has to be a certain thrill of that, like other writers talk about on Twitter or in other places, when, you know, when you get you check your inbox and you got new art from, you know, guys like Jerome Pena and Tony Moore. Right. So that's always a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's at one point everything was converging. Mm-hmm. I had pages coming in from Greg Tokini and Eric Canetti and Tony Moore and Jerome Pena, and you know, it is as much fun as anything could be, you know, working with such next generation geniuses as these guys. Mm-hmm. And all of these guys, as good as they are, the one thing that ties them together is their adherence to storytelling over giant splashy images. They're not guys who are trying to sell pages, you know. They're not trying to wedge in some big super shot of the character in order to, you know, get 50 more bucks for the original. They're all focused on storytelling first. And it might not sell their pages as quickly, but I think that people respond, and I think that, you know, that's why they're as good as they are. They're restrained and mature, and you know, not only are they amazing illustrators, they're also genius storytellers, and that's what you need to be to make good comic books.
That's fantastic. You know, we kind of got into the middle of your Marvel stuff already. I wanted to, you know, you mentioned that you started collaborating with Matt on War Journal, and you guys got to have Howard Chaykin draw your stuff.
Yeah,
that has to be a real thrill to have like someone like that. Well, you know, like your very first thing with Marvel, you got this guy to draw it.
It's Howard Chaykin. Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, and you know, with the Punisher, actually, my brother-in-law wanted me to kind of bring this up. He's a big fan of your Punisher work, particularly of Frankencastle. And he was very, very disappointed that it had to end the way it did. I was curious, though, you know, when you were, how was it like pitching that particular project? You know, the Frankencastle story.
Axel was editing the book with Sebastian Gerner, and we had all come to a point where we all agreed that Frank had bitten off so much that it made sense for him to die. And we'd all agreed on this, that Frank was going to die. But I didn't want it to just be another, oh, the Punisher dies, and, you know, Henry comes and takes his place, or Lady Punisher steps up to the role. And then a year go by, and then the resurrection, I'm back, you know. I just didn't want to follow the same sort of road with this. And so in many conversations with Tony Moore and Axel and Sebastian, this thing kind of grew together, and it started off where I was reading articles about a powder, a substance called extracellular matrix, which regenerates cells. You know, there's been people who have had the tips of their fingers cut off, and there exists in reality this extracellular matrix that you can put on the tip, and it grew back the rest of the finger. So I'm thinking that if technology like that actually exists, you know, here and now, but in the Marvel Universe, it's not too far fetched to imagine that there could be stuff that would patch a body back together. And so originally it wasn't going to have the supernatural bent to it. It was just going to be that Henry got this extracellular matrix and put Frank back together. Mm-hmm. And then it became, it just felt like, well, what's the fucking point? Like, Frank dies, and then Frank gets, like, stuck back together with magic glue, and off he goes to kill more guys, you know. Take that, Mexican. Pop, 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 pop. You won't sell pot in my neighborhood, Puerto Rican. Choop, 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 choop. And the shit bores me so much. It just bores the shit out of me. So I thought that, you know, hey, I've got this idea that something I was cooking up where all of the monsters in the Marvel Universe have taken over the Morlock tunnels. I loved the idea that all these Kirby and Ditko and Stan Lee weirdo creatures were down there, as well as all the Englehart, like, you know, man thing, and all the various, you know, weirdo characters from Howard the Duck, and all the, just all the monsters, you know, Werewolf by Night, Dracula, Son of Satan was down there. I was just thinking, like, what if there was a monster metropolis, you know, and the Legion of Monsters were like the superheroes for these guys, and I always loved it so much, and I was like, well, why can't that story be this story? And so we got to talking about it with Axel, and he was intrigued by it. He goes, well, you know, all right, tell me the story. And I was like, so the monsters live down there. They've been hiding. They're being hunted by monster hunters. Frank Castle gets killed. He gets chopped up. Dokken kicks his body over, you know, into this blown open sewer, from during their fight. And so we end with the pieces of the Punisher scattered around, blown up, cut up, dead. And then the next issue, Moloids are collecting his pieces and sacks. because these monsters are being hunted, they see the body of the Punisher, and they're like, hey, you know, our buddy Morbius is a scientist, and he knows how, you know, he's buddies with Frankenstein and knows a thing or two about reanimating corpses. So why don't we collect this war tactician here and bring him down? He can help us. And then, you know, Axel had the idea, you know, I was saying that these Hammer agents are chasing the Moloids, and Axel's like, and then around the corner, who shows up? Man-Thing. And, you know, and I was like, yeah. And then the next thing, you know, I mean, we were both just screaming, like, yeah, and then Man-Thing slaps the shit out of him. And then, you know, the next thing, you know, it fades to black, and you started waking up, and you know, and who's there but Morbius and the Werewolf by Night. And then, you know, Frank's all like crazy out of his head, and you know, looks in the mirror, and then you get the big splash reveal that he's been turned into a Frankenstein monster. That's the kind of shit that I want to be doing. You know, that was so much fun, and we were all so excited about it that it was a pleasure. It was a real joy to see Tony be able to take his time. I mean, Tony was spending like 3 days on a page on that stuff. And, you know, underneath it all, it's The Unforgiven. I mean, it's Frank ends up becoming this cowboy living on the edge of town as the land baron sends his gangsters in to scare the town folk. But instead, it's monsters being attacked by samurai monster hunters led by a German corpse and a robot that used to hang out with Ulysses Bloodstone.
it was such a great concept, and I was kind of sad that it ended so soon, because like I thought a year was not enough. I thought we could have taken 2 years to do this whole story and have him do more crazy things. Right. I was glad that you guys got to do it all, because it was really I thought it was a really ballsy move of on Marvel's part to let you do it. I mentioned my brother-in-law earlier. That dude is the most hardcore Punisher Max guy out there. He's a big Garth Ennis guy. Uh-huh. But then he got into your stuff, and he was like, "Man, this is great!" And he said, "And you know, this whole thing takes place in the Marvel universe. Of course, stuff like this can happen." You know?
Yeah, I mean, you know, while the Max, and that was one of the mandates that Axel handed down, was, you know, Jason's going to be relaunching Max. It's going to be street level crime, and you need to fit your book into the Marvel universe proper. And so it fit into the Dark Reign stuff with the Hood and Norman Osborn and resurrecting supervillains. I tried to just dip it in all of the craziness of the Marvel Universe, mm-hmm. but maintain in the center of it all, single-minded, crazy Frank Castle being the Punisher. And I think that the people who didn't enjoy it, who were Max fans, tended to not enjoy it, I think, as an aesthetic thing, because they didn't like the monsters. Because underneath it all, it really is still the Punisher, and it really is still a Punisher story.
Yeah, I thought people were a little extreme with their dislike, and some were downright rude about it. Like, you know, I remember we kind of talked about this a little bit at New York Comic Con. There's some dude in wearing camouflage gear went to one of the panels and gave you crap about that. I thought, really?
Sure.
Did you feel that strongly about the Punisher?
Yeah, I mean, I get it. I don't get it, actually, because the bottom line is, you know, if you're true to your voice, you're not going to be. You're not going to be accessible to everybody, and you're not. And we knew that going into this. I knew immediately that people who are, you know, Punisher diehards who really didn't enjoy the Spirit of Vengeance take on him that happened in the Marvel Knights run, I knew that there was going to be immediate comparisons and that they weren't actually going to read it and find out what it was or give it a shot. I knew all that. I mean, we're not stupid. Axel knew, Tony knew, but we didn't care. You know, like the people who love it, like somebody sent me the on Amazon, if you go and look at the reviews, they're all 5 stars or 1 stars.
Yeah, it's really polarizing. You know, like,
yeah, that's it. Success. If all I have is if you go on Amazon and you see 5 5-star reviews and 3 1-star reviews, fucking A, that's as good as it gets, because, you know, you didn't get a meh out of anybody. You either got, like, this is the craziest, most fun ever, and I want more comics like this, or you got, how dare you not know what Punisher is? and you know, I didn't mean to lean on the guy who didn't like it in terms of the my choice of portrayal. but that's a good thing, and that's what we should be doing. We should be doing things that are slightly polarizing and true. So, you know, I think that the choice was like, look, my career at Marvel was either going to be based on me, and it was going to succeed based on me doing what I like and working with people I like and having fun and doing things that are inventive and big and unique, or it was going to be me trying to do that and fail. But I wasn't going to not, you know, try these things. I'm not going to not do what I like, and also take those same risks. I would much rather fail being who I am and trying to do what I want than succeed at pandering.
Adam, you had something to ask?
Yeah, how much of a different experience process-wise and with waiting for the reaction and everything was working on Bulletstorm for you? Like process-wise and with the writing side of it, and you know, with waiting to see how the reaction was for everything, how different was working on Bulletstorm compared to working on, you know, a Marvel book where there's a set level of expectation and things like that?
Bulletstorm was a dream because I came up with the space pirate angle for the characters so that they weren't just, you know, a hardened band of Marines, which was something that was already written into them, so I had to incorporate it. So I just made it, well, they used to be Marines, and now they're pirates. the basic stuff was already set up. You know, it was already going to be, they're going to be sent down and chase this general. But they really let me sort of make fun of it and have a wink of a nod, like, yeah, you know, oh, we're chasing the evil general. If anybody would prefer that to be taken, like, deathly serious, then they're not my kind of people anyway. So what I did was I wrote the structure in a way that I would write anything. I wrote it in a three-act structure, and I tried to make I hit all of the traditional storytelling beats with it. But then when it came to the dialogue, I just figured, hey, if these guys are Marines who are now space pirates, they're going to be salty dogs. You know, they're going to be a little blue. And so I started writing them cursing at each other a little bit, and it bored me. And I felt kind of cringy, like, oh, you know, the F word. Oh, I'm saying shit. So what I did was I just tried to use it. I tried to, you know, spice it up and have them curse in the way that me and my friends curse at each other, or, you know, in ways that seemed a little more interesting. And, you know, so instead of, oh, you know, you scared the shit out of me, I just write, oh, you scared the dick off of me. And it was really weird that people latched onto that so much, because it's a six-hour campaign. You play the game for 6 hours. And yeah, they might call each other, hey, you dick, get over here. But there's not like dick jokes. I'm a fan of, you know, I like a dick joke. It's like a piece of intestine hanging out of the front of your body. It's funny. You know, I find the smartest people I know are usually also pretty lowbrow. Whereas people who are hyper concerned about perception, and being seen as smart can't possibly be lowbrow, because they're very concerned that the world will not see them as smart. So there was, a lot of freedom with the developers. People can fly an epic, And everybody was laughing and having fun. You know, they're like, hey, this is a great game. And all of a sudden this pirate is, you know, spouting off with all this crazy blue language. And, you know, it was like, it was a joy. It was a real joy. And then getting to see it all come together and play it. I love the game. I mean, I think it's tremendous. And so the fact that it was a success was nice. And it was the same thing as Frankencastle. It was polarizing in that some people, you know, like, well, this is really mature. You're like, oh, God, get over yourself, shithead. You know, it's a video game about killing mutants. What do you want? Like, you killed my grandfather. I'll get you, mutant. Pop, 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 pop. John, get over here. My leg hurts. You know, that melodrama bullshit that all these games are packed with that these fucking mouth breathers think is so highfalutin. You know, like, no, it's melodrama, stupid. Like, why are we going to lean into more of that boring garbage? And so those people, again, it's like I had an argument with somebody online that I realized was fruitless and pointless. And I was trying to bring up, I'm like, so Lenny Bruce and Louis C.K., these guys are, you know, they have no influence and they're just lowbrow and juvenile and stupid by your argument. So anytime anybody, you know, like Louis C.K. was recently on the Jon Stewart show talking about why farts are funny.
Awesome. That was so great.
And he just nails it. And Louis C.K. is so smart and so honest. And he's also got a philosophical, you know, grounding and a point to make. He's a thoughtful, intelligent guy who will tell you a fart joke occasionally.
Did you see the interview he did with Pitchfork just recently?
No. Is it online?
He had this really cool bit where he was talking about how if the guys from Jackass had a Yale education and were doing this on campus, how people would be studying them and making giant documentaries about them and how they're genius performance artists. He's got such a cool perspective. You're totally spot on with that.
Yeah, he really does. And most of the guys that I respect, you know, like the Mr. Show guys, you know, they're a little crass, and they're all smart dudes, and they don't need to, you know, I have this theory that smart people don't need to put on airs or use the $10 words because they don't give a fuck. And, you know, what was it Hemingway said, I know the big words, I just don't use them. They don't bring on emotion. The big words are I write to convey emotion, and the big words don't get emotion. I think that smart people like a little perversion, and to be honest about it, and to be able to chuckle at a fart, you know. Whereas people who maybe aren't need to put on the airs and sell people on another perception of themselves. So. To me, it was a risk, same as Frankencastle was. I knew that I was taking, you know, a big epic franchise game, and I was writing it in a way that hadn't really been done in a video game. And, you know, a lot of people tried to compare it to Duke Nukem, which is ridiculous because I don't respect the writing in that. Not to shit on whoever did it. I'm sure they worked really hard. It's not for me. Anyway, I don't want to sit here and be critical of other people's work, but the game doesn't. In my opinion, have much in common with that. But and I think people who got it really got it, and they responded to it. And that's the great thing is, you know, when you make a product that isn't vanilla beans, some people are going to love it and some people are going to hate it, but the people who love it are really going to love it, as opposed to doing something that was sort of accessible to everybody and a little more broad, but nobody really loved it. I would rather have you know, a smaller portion of people love it with all of their heart than have everybody who plays it just go, yeah, it's pretty good.
That's very cool. And you've talked about, you know, through the interview here, just doing stuff that you want to do, and especially when it's, you know, on corporate-owned projects, how much of a leeway do you get with that, or is it the sort of thing where you just bail off it if they weren't letting you take that kind of direction with it?
If you're working with a good editor, then, you know, they hired you because of your voice and who you are, and they want you to do what you do. If you're working with an editor who likes you, which you should be working with, then you should be doing what is true to you, and you know, they'll rein you in and help you find the best way to do it. And I'm fortunate in that I have that in my current projects right now with the you know, what's coming out. You know, with Jody and I on X-Force, two people couldn't care more about a book, and so I have a bunch of big ideas, and he'll talk me through them and make sure that it's not just me falling in love with a visual, and that we've got heart and emotion, and that, you know, we argue and argue and argue, and by the time we're done arguing, we have a good story. And that's what it should be. You know, somebody once said, I'm probably misquoting this, and I don't recall who said it, but there's a thought process in comics that by being easy to work with, you're being professional. And I say, fuck that shit. If you're easy to work with, you're probably just being a limp noodle who gives the editor what they say they want without any pushback because you want your career to keep climbing. And I don't want my career to keep climbing if that's how I have to do it. I want to work with guys who are willing to go back and forth and rework a comic book 4 or 5 times and to argue about it and to get in there and punch each other until we find the right idea. And nobody gives way until they are sure that it's the right idea. And I'm really fortunate right now, and then I'm working with Jody LaHoop on X-Force and Stephen Wacker on Venom. And these guys care, and so we do that, you know. And they give pushback to me all the time, and I give pushback to them, and we collaborate and we make good books. So I've been very fortunate in that I might not rocket to the top of the industry the way I'm doing things, but the way I'm doing things are true to my sensibility, and I figure that it'll take me wherever it's supposed to take me. You know, and if it seems to have taken me to, I'm incredibly excited. I've got some unannounced huge projects coming up at Marvel, three, and wish to God I could talk about. They're all just gigantic, huge, people are enjoying the work, and I didn't compromise. It's the best of all worlds, and you know, I guess that. The bottom line for me was always that I didn't want to one day be walking across the street and see like an out of control bus careening, coming to crush me. and then think, oh my God, I pandered and I made a bunch of bullshit. Oh my God, my life was making bullshit, you know, crunch. Your work is important. And I know that, you know, be it indie comics that are a little more personal, like Blackheart Billy or Nightmare or Fear Agent, or my Marvel work, people who read that first arc of X-Force, and they're like, you and Jerome are so good. Where'd you guys come from? No, Jerome and I have been working together for half a decade, and here's other books we've done that you can go buy. And fans of Venom with Tony, like, I haven't seen Tony since The Walking Dead. And I'm like, well, we've done 4 volumes of Fear Agent, and Jerome Pena and I did the other 2 or 3. Like, it's all love. It's the same amount of quality. It's just dudes who love making comics. So hopefully as more people are find the work, at Marvel, and because we are doing the same work that we have always done and we're staying true to our voices, hopefully that'll also lead people backwards to some of the other stuff in our catalog. And hopefully it'll, you know, I feel gratified by it. If nothing else, I think by being true to who you are and your own voice, things will take you where they're supposed to take you at that point, I figure.
Definitely. You kind of, before we kind of close out, I just wanted to talk a little bit about X-Force since you mentioned them, and that is my current favorite of your of all the X-Men books that have been going right now. And I was curious were you approached to do the book, or did you pitch for this particular title?
When Axel was still running the X-Office, he mentioned it would be coming up. And he asked me if I would be interested, and I proceeded to shit my pants full and jump out of a window because I'm a huge X nerd, and this team was something of a dream team. It really is.
Were you responsible for picking the team members themselves, or was it something that was presented to you?
It was presented. It was something that had been workshopped at an X retreat, and but, you know, I being an X-Nerd, I already connected all the dots. I'm like, wow, you know, Warning, you know, Warren and Betsy are going to be back together, and because we're going to do this, and, oh, the Archangel persona has really never been explored, and why even? So I wrote up a pitch on that, and I got the book. And that was a dream job, and, we spent I mean, there was a period there where all I was doing was ramping up on X-Force and keeping Punisher moving. So I had a lot of time to give the end of Punisher in the Blood and that first arc of X-Force all the love that I had. I wanted to make sure in the Blood on Punisher ended as strong as we began with Jerome on that first arc that I did. And I wanted to make sure that the X-Force stuff was worthy of Jerome spending the time he spends. So, you know, dumped a hell of a lot of time into that stuff, and it seems to have paid off, you know, like people have enjoyed it. And, you know, I think that the tone we took and the putting in jokes and lightening it up a little bit and trying to make it more high adventure, it could have gone either way. I was nervous that people were gonna not respond as well as they did. And again, it's a case of you just have to trust your own instincts and do what you like, and hopefully there'll be an audience for it.
Yeah, I thought the way you handled the character interactions was fantastic. And there was an issue, I think it's issue 5, where Deadpool, you know, out of all the characters, gets to be the one that actually shows like the most human emotion towards something that they just did. And I thought that was really a great moment. And the book is full of moments like that where, you know, the each individual character gets to shine. I always thought, wow, this guy has to be a real X-Fan, and you just pretty much confirmed that here, that you're a big X-Men guy, because of the way you seem to really have a good grasp on all of them. Now, with the current storyline there, you know, they're doing the whole Age of Apocalypse thing. I was curious, you know, was this... this is something that you wanted to revisit, or was there something editorial pitched to you? Because I think this is kind of a really big story, so I just want to see.
Excuse me.
Go ahead.
No, it was. This is all story stuff that I wanted to do, and working with Jody, who has definitely had a lot to do with the soup as well. Mm-hmm. It all came about building a story about Apocalypse and the ramifications. The biggest thing for me was that if we're going to end the first arc the way we ended the first arc, that it not just be like, ba-dum-bum, ba-dum-bum, and we did this thing, and now we're going to go do another thing. I felt like there was a responsibility as a writer to make sure that the consequences of their actions here, though you can debate, and that's the fun of the story, whether they were right or wrong, one way or another, there have to be consequences. And given that Warren and Archangel have never been perfectly explored what the death persona is or how this stuff works, I thought that was a nice opportunity to sort of explore that. And then, you know, I sort of built this big story about what was going on and Phantom X's involvement, which we haven't revealed yet, and a lot of other crazy, you know, ideas. And it led to the Age of Apocalypse because, you know, there's so many pieces on the board in terms of characters that have been created by or altered by Apocalypse. I felt like I wanted to do one big grand story that tied them all together, focused in on what Archangel is, who he is, what he is, you know, how it all works. And you know, I figured if I'm telling a big Apocalypse story, I probably should go to the Age of Apocalypse. And it's one of those things that it's a big high concept. It's a big you know, like it could go either way. And again, anytime you have one of these ideas, they're usually born of necessity if you're doing it correctly. And this was, mm-hmm. And it was born of, well, think about all the characters that are alive there that aren't alive here. And how much emotional reaction you can get from Wolverine.
Oh, yeah. I just saw the preview for issue 12. And yeah, that really ties into what you just said.
Yeah, and it will. I mean, that's the responsibility of it. You know, Wolverine's daughter with Mariko is alive there. Jean Grey, Nightcrawler, his arch-enemy nemesis, Sabretooth. He's basically surrounded by people who, you know, are either didn't exist in our world or are dead. And that's a character story, you know, and that's what you need. And so each one of these arcs, I've tried to focus on another character. The first arc, I tried to give equal billing to everyone. And then the second one really focused in on Phantom X and a little bit of Deadpool. And then we went in and focused, you know, an issue on Betsy and then an issue on Logan and then an issue on Warren. And now the first part of the Dark Angel saga, when we're in the Age of Apocalypse, is focusing in on Wolverine and getting into his head and his headset, which I haven't done. You know, it's a character everybody knows, but I wanted to make sure that if I was going to, when I did focus my spotlight on Wolverine, that I had a story to tell and a unique perspective and a unique situation. And so him in the Age of Apocalypse, surrounded by these versions of his friends and loved ones, that's what's interesting about it to me, more than just the Age of Apocalypse.
All right. That's such a great story that's running right now. I really can't wait to see how it ends. And you work with a lot of really, really good artists in that book. You've had Jerome on, you've had Billy Tan on, you've had Esad Ribic, of course, and of course Mark Brooks.
Yeah, I
just love it, man. It's always a treat whenever a new issue comes out, and sometimes you get an extra issue each month. It's always better. And of course, you got Dean White, who really keeps the look of the book going and consistent. And even when you even had Paul Mounts do, you know, he covered for Dean for an issue. I think he did a good job, kind of maintaining the feel of the book as well. Really good team on that book.
Yeah. I was going to say Dean is tremendous, and he really does tie all the different artists together with, you know, he unifies the look of the series, and Matt Wilson coloring over Esad was gorgeous as well. You know, we've had some other guys, but we've been really fortunate in the art teams that we've had, and coming up in year two, you're not going to believe it. You know, like, I think we're fortunate in that we've established this is the book that is the art book, and so. We've got a tremendous lineup of guys who are coming on board. And then you've got five issues from Jerome coming up, half of which are already done. And I can attest to the fact that they're even better than the first arc. And Jerome's back on issue 14. The stuff that Brooks is doing is just stunning. So there's a bunch of that coming up. You still got 12 and 13 with Brooks. Excuse me. So, yeah, the book is blessed artistically, for sure. And then we've got these gorgeous Esad Ribic covers on every issue. So, and it adds a consistency, you know, having the Esad covers. I'm really glad he decided to stick around.
Well, I'm looking forward to whatever comes up in the next year. I'm definitely excited for it, especially with the whole Schism thing going on later this year. So it should be interesting to see how that would affect your book later on.
Sure.
Adam, you have one last question for Rick?
Yeah, since we're wrapping up here, I think the world wants to know, who would win in a fight, Grayson Hunt or Heath Houston?
Oh, Heath Houston, come on.
Yeah, come on, Heath Houston.
He knows his way around a laser gun.
Yeah, and yeah.
Actually, Rick, where can people find you online?
You can go to rickremender.com, and I've also got a Facebook fan page that I try and keep up with.
Awesome. And once again, Rick, thank you very much for coming on board. And we look forward to having you back eventually once they start, when they announce all that stuff you were just talking about, or maybe when more good stuff starts coming out. We look forward. You are one of our favorite writers, and I just love the stuff that you do. It's just so much fun, and it's always a breath of fresh air when there's a lot of books that come out there, and sometimes you just feel like you buy books out of habit. But whenever I buy one of your books, it's always, man,
an event.
Yeah, it feels like an event because there's always something fun, something ridiculous going on that you'd only see in a comic book that you write. So again, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for the kind words. It means the world.
Yeah, we'll talk to you again soon, sir. Take care.
Okay, take care.
All right, bye-bye.
Sky, lay down the sand. keep falling over, I keep passing out when I see.